Happy Epiphany. Yeah, happy Epiphany. Today is the day in the church calendar where we celebrate Epiphany Sunday. So I hope you have all your Epiphany decorations up and have your Epiphany pies and cakes cooked and your Epiphany shopping done. Epiphany is one of those feasts or celebrations in the Christian calendar. Again, it's been celebrated for thousands of years, but in the West and in sort of a more Protestant culture, we don't tend to be as much aware of some of these festivals, but they really do matter. And so we're going to talk about Epiphany today. And Epiphany, the word, just means a sudden revelation. And so it is related in a way to what we talked about last week, that word apocalypse. Apocalypse was the revelation, was seeing behind the veil, seeing that which is not seen by our regular eyes, but seeing by the Spirit. And a revelation is like an epiphany. Now, we can use that in normal life, just an epiphany. I had a sudden revelation of something. But in the sense of Christian faith, it actually means more of a revelation of God, a sudden revelation of God to humans. And that's what we celebrate today. And Epiphany this week celebrates the revelation of God through Jesus to specifically the Gentiles. People know who Gentiles are? Yeah, look around. That's us. Yeah, maybe it's not everybody, but it's non-Jewish people. Kind of, it's a general term for non-Jewish people, the Gentiles. And that's a pretty big deal, that there was an epiphany of God through Jesus to non-Jewish people. Why is that such a big deal for us here today? Because we're here today, because we're gathering, because we're talking and singing about God. And if that epiphany had not happened to the Gentiles, then we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't know. And so we see in the story of the early church, in the book of Acts, and in the life of Jesus, there are multiple epiphanies from God to the Gentiles. And it's because the good news of God in Jesus could not be contained, it could not be restrained to just one group of people. In fact, the epiphanies to the Gentiles are, in part, the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. Abraham, the father of the faith. And to Abraham, God said, I will make you a blessing to the nations. And that's us. Have a quick look around. There's a lot of nations here. I know we just did this, but it's okay to do it again. Look around. There's a lot of nations here. There's a lot of languages here. I was just talking with Selena about how the kingdom of God is every tribe, every nation, every tongue. That's the description of the kingdom of God. And so actually, that's kind of what churches should look like, is every tribe, every nation, every tongue. I bet if we did a little study, we'd find probably dozens of languages spoken just in this small gathering today. And that is beautiful. That is wonderful. We're not just enriched culturally by that. We're enriched spiritually. And we are living out that which we are supposed to be living in the kingdom of God. And so Abraham is a blessing to the nations. And we're proof of that. We're fruit of that here today. But the specific epiphany that this feast is based upon comes from a very, very strange story in the Bible that we kind of have normalized. It's from Matthew 2. We've normalized it because we've probably read it a lot. We've seen it acted out in nativity plays with cute kids. And we've sung a biblically inaccurate song about it quite a lot. And it is the Epiphany to the Magi of We Three Kings fame. If I never have to hear that song again, I'll be happy. It's not a great song, but you know, that's how we kind of know about it. And so we've normalized this very, very, very strange, dangerous, political story. And we've kind of sanitized it and made it just fun to have kids play it out. But it's a story of unrest and potential revolution and fear and dread and murder. That's the story. And we say, hey, kids, put on the costume and off you go. But that's the story that we are actually celebrating in Epiphany. These magi were the first Gentiles to encounter Jesus and to have revealed to them something of his divinity. They said, we've come to worship him, which would have been a very, very strange thing to say in a Jewish culture. We've come to worship this child. That doesn't make sense. But in their culture, it probably made a bit more sense. So let's start to read it. This is from Matthew 2, 1 to 3. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So these magi, these wise men from the east, are not exactly welcome in Jerusalem. Did you catch that in the story? They come and they make their announcement, which is strange. And then it says, Herod is disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. We should pay attention to that. There's a reason that they put that in. Herod is disturbed. Well, we can understand why they weren't particularly welcome to King Herod, yeah? This is a disturbing message. Because their message represents a direct threat to his rule, to his kingship. Herod was the king of Judea, king of the Jews, and he was relatively trusted by the Romans. Herod, if you didn't know, he wasn't ethnically Jewish, he was Edomite. But his father was an official in Rome. Herod had major connections in Rome, which led to him getting the kingship over Judea. And his job was to rule Judea at the pleasure of Rome and to keep the peace and to keep tax money from Judea flowing back to the center of the empire. That's his job. That's what keeps him as king. If we go to the next slide. We have to pause here for a moment and actually talk about empires and how empires work. It's surprising how well Star Wars actually explains how empires work. The original series, and I'm not going to talk a lot about Star Wars, don't worry, but the original Star Wars, when you ask George Lucas about it, he says, yeah, it's essentially about Vietnam. And who is the empire to Vietnam? It's like you've thought you've been on one side, but you've actually been on the wrong side the whole time. And then the most recent show, Andor, tells a very clear story about empire and what empire does and what its role is. And so I'm going to give you a bit of an explanation of empire. And I'm not just doing this as a Star Wars fan, but as somebody I studied very specifically the history of warfare and military in university and the politics of empire, and I teach this at a university level. So I'll give you just a little bit of a sense of what empire is, and then I'll explain why this matters for the story of the Magi, which we have kids play out in the Nativity. So empires have a center, right? Whether it's Coruscant in Star Wars, or Rome, or London, or Istanbul, or Tokyo, or Moscow, or Washington. It always has a center. And that center is where the power and the influence and the money is. And if you want to advance politically, that's where you want to be. If you want to have real power, you want to be in the center. And then you have the secondary areas of empire. And the secondary areas of empire, they get privileges and protection, just fewer privileges and a little less protection, but they do have a privileged relationship with the center, and their job is to support and legitimize the center. So an example of this would actually be Canada, with a couple different empires. Canada had that role, a secondary role in the British Empire. Canada has had that role in the American Empire. We were the secondary. We're not the center, but we were given a privileged kind of relationship. some protections, and our job was in some ways to support and legitimize the center. And then you have the third areas, the tertiary areas, the margins. And in the example of our story here in Matthew 2, Judea is not the center. And that's actually hard for us to understand because we have centered so much of our faith and our story around Judea that and Jerusalem that we tend to think that that's the center of the story, but it very much was not. According to the Roman Empire, nobody was really thinking about Judea. Judea was on the margins. Judea was a place where nobody, particularly from the center, wanted to be. If you were sent there, it means maybe you were on the way up or maybe you were on the way down, but you didn't really want to be there. That's not where the center of power was at all. And what the empire wants to do with the third places, it wants to control them and it wants to extract resources from them. And we need to understand this about empire. The empire doesn't particularly care about the people there. It wants them for what it can flow back to the center. It wants their resources, their money, fuel, gold, whatever it happens to be. And it's often in these marginal spaces where wars are fought. Wars are fought in the third spaces because no empire wants to fight a war in its center. That's not where you want. So the third spaces act kind of as buffers. We'll fight over there so we don't destroy our own homes. We don't mind destroying the homes in the third spaces. You can think of recent examples of this in Vietnam, Korea, Cuba, Afghanistan, where empires, partly what was happening there is empires were fighting with one another by proxy, at a distance, through other nations, as they were trying to keep control of the resources. So the number one priority of empire in those third spaces is to keep control, take resource. Is that clear? If empire can't control those areas, what they do is they destabilize them. They create disorder and violence. And when you create disorder and violence and instability, then you can say to the people, well, look at all this instability here. The only people who can take care of this is us, the center. You need our power to recreate order and peace. And that can feel very, very convincing, particularly on the ground. And this has happened very recently. We have examples of this within the last century. This happened in Guatemala in 1954, in the Dominican Republic in 1965, in Chile in 1973, Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1980s, Panama in 1989, and it's still happening today. You can make a very clear argument. I had already written this before what happened yesterday, just so we're all clear. But what happened yesterday in Venezuela, you can make an absolute, I mean, I don't even think you have to make a case. I think the case has been made. Where the argument is, we're going to take back the resources that were taken from us. That was the American argument in Venezuela. Regions are destabilized through threats, by refusing asylum, through terror, bombing, regime change to someone more favorable to the empire. And the goal is to reestablish control over the resources. And again, I don't even feel, this isn't like a marginal view. The center yesterday said, we're not leaving Venezuela, we're going to run the country, we are in the oil business, we will be selling oil. That's a direct quote. So that's what's happening. And it's not new, and it's not partisan. It's actually not left or right. This is just what empires do, and it runs by the script. That's what happens. And the Romans had a word for it. They called it the Pax Romana. That means the Roman peace. And what that meant was they were in the center and they had their legions. And on the margins, if people stopped keeping the peace and if the flow of resources stopped coming back to them, they would say, keep the peace or we'll come and kill you. We will make peace by killing you. And they would literally go and do it. The Pax Romana. And they had a statement. Their motto was peace through strength. And yesterday, a very well-known American evangelist said, this is peace through strength. Peace through strength. That's the Pax Romana. That was the Pax Britannia. That's the Pax Americana. That's how empire works. But when we read the New Testament, we have to realize that the Roman concept of their peace through strength is literally what it's talking about in the book of Revelation as anti-Christ. That is not the way of Christ. It isn't peace. It certainly is not the peace of the gospel. It is not the peace of the Prince of Peace. And we know this because there's one further step that empire will do. If empire cannot reestablish control of the region, it will destroy the marginal regions so that nobody else can have them. And when we think about what's going on around the world right now, death and destruction and displacement and genocide, it's all politically motivated, justified under the necessities of empire. We will control you. If we can't control you, we'll destabilize you. If we can't regain control, we will destroy you. That is what empire does and has always done. And here's why this matters for our story today. Herod, King Herod, understood this perfectly well. He knew that that's what the Roman Empire does, and he understood his role in it perfectly well. This is a political story. Herod was politically shrewd. As the king of the Jews, though he wasn't ethnically Jewish, he practiced Judaism. He had done massive building projects. He built the second temple in Jerusalem, the one whose western wall, sometimes known as the Wailing Wall, still stands today. King Herod made that. He called himself and was known as Herod the Great, which is pretty good PR. If your name ends with the great and not the lesser, it's pretty good. That's what you want to be known. Great, 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 great. That has to be associated with your name all the time, this tyrant. Great, 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 great. But he was also brutal. He killed many members of his family, including his wife and children, because in his paranoia and his growing tyranny, he believed that they were plotting against him. He would clearly do anything to secure his rule, to stay in Rome's good books, to keep the flow of resources going back to Rome. So, knowing that, some strange foreigners coming from the east show up in Jerusalem and announce that there is a new king of the Jews. Not welcome. Herod is disturbed. Understandably so. Is that fair of Herod to be a little disturbed? Can we have some empathy for King Herod? I know we're not supposed to, but can we? We go, yeah, I get why you're bothered by this. But okay, but why was Jerusalem? It says all of Jerusalem was disturbed. Not just because King Herod is disturbed, all of Jerusalem is disturbed. Well, we talked last week about how the Jewish people were in Judea, but they weren't in charge. And they'd been conquered by Babylon, the Babylonian Empire in 586. They were taken into exile. The temple was destroyed. Then they got to go back to Jerusalem, but they were ruled by the Persians, and then the Medes, and then the Greeks, and now the Romans. And the Roman Empire did not care what the Jewish people or any other marginal people groups did. They did not care. So long as peace was kept and money kept flowing. It's why the issue of taxes came up so much in Jesus' ministry, because people wanted to know, should we keep paying the tax? This is our primary kind of concern, our primary threat right now is Rome. Should we keep paying that, or is now the time to rebel? Should we fight them? What does God want? And there were various factions within Judea that wanted different things. There were zealots who wanted a violent revolution. There were Pharisees who wanted spiritual resistance. There were a group called the Essenes who wanted spiritual and physical separation. And then there were the Herodians who followed King Herod and the Sadducees who really wanted the status quo based in Jerusalem, around the temple, around King Herod. But everyone knew, if trouble started in Judea and it came to the attention of Rome, eventually Rome would deal with it through the Pax Romana. Keep the peace or we will kill you. And the way that Rome asserted its power, asserted its will around the world, is the central symbol of our faith. Do we have one here? Yeah, we do. Crucifixions. We have to remember, when we look at the cross, that this was the instrument of Roman terror, of Roman control. Thousands of Jewish men would be crucified and would be left along the roads, crucified. That was how Rome said, we own you. We control you. You fight us. This is what happened. And the purpose of the cross was to utterly, completely dehumanize the victim. That's what a crucifixion was. And the people of Jerusalem knew, they had seen this happen, and they knew if people start talking about a new king, a Messiah, well, trouble is starting. They were disturbed. So all of Jerusalem is reasonably disturbed alongside Herod. So who are these disturbing magi, these foreigners who walk into this political powder keg with a lit match? Like, they just, you know, everything is just being kind of contained, and it's all fine, and there's been no revolutions for a little while, and along come the magi, go, hey, guess what? There's a new king born. Celebrate with us. And everyone's like, yeah, no, that doesn't seem like a really good idea. Shh. They followed a star to find the king of the Jews, who they're going to worship. Jewish people do not worship kings. They do not worship humans. They don't necessarily want, some want a new Messiah, some don't. They just don't want to be crucified. What's going on? Who are these people? They didn't know. Herod didn't know. To be honest, we don't know. Who are the Magi? We don't particularly know. They may have come from the same area that the Jewish people had been exiled in years before, part of Persia, which is Iraq and Iran now. And maybe there they had become familiar in a way with certain Jewish prophecies. That's possible, but we don't really know. These characters are strange. And so Herod takes action. And he actually takes the correct political action. Let's read from Matthew 2, 4 to 6. And when he had assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people, Israel. So he gathers his advisors together. He consolidates his power. He gathers information. And whether he believes in this prophecy or not, and probably he doesn't, but whether he does or not, it's beside the point. He knows that it's out there. He knows that the people do believe it. He knows that he can use this religious belief. And he knows that he has to act, because this is dangerous. So let's look at Matthew 2, 7 to 8. Then Herod called the Magi secretly. This is CIA stuff going on here. Secretly. Herod called the Magi secretly and learned from them the exact time the star had appeared. And sending them to Bethlehem, he said, go and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. Do you think he is being sincere here? No, we know, and we know the rest of the story. We know he's not being sincere, but the Magi don't know that. They don't know that. And so he is trying to recruit the Magi, says he's on their side, use them to gather more information. Again, politically, this is the right move. This is very intelligent to do. You can even make the case that his later actions, including ordering the death of all the male children under 3 in the area, follows a kind of brutal political logic. If Herod could snuff out the threat early days, then he could protect his own rule and he could protect his people from Roman punishment. Politicians and their supporters use this kind of logic to this day to justify all kinds of oppression, displacement, war, and genocide. It's better to do this. In fact, it's said later on in the Jesus story where one of the members of the kind of the religious elite said, isn't it better for one man to die than for the whole nation to die? Isn't it better for us just to have Jesus crucified rather than all of us get killed in this rebellion? There's a political logic to it. And it's kind of correct, except that there's something missing, isn't there? Revelation. Apocalypse. Epiphany. A word from the Lord. Herod is acting from his own wisdom and political instincts, and they are shrewd, wise, and powerful. But he doesn't know. He can't know the true nature of what's going on. That revelation hasn't been given to Herod. Who has it been given to? Elizabeth and Zechariah, old priest and his wife in Jerusalem. Not the center of any Roman story, that's for sure. To Mary and Joseph, even less of the center. To shepherds out in a field, even less of the center. To these strange foreigners, the Magi, who show up. We'll read the rest of the story, Matthew 2, 9 to 12. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with great delight. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they fell down and worshipped him. And then they opened their treasures and presented him with the gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they withdrew to their country by another route. How did the Magi get their epiphany? Dreams and stars. Does that make anybody here uncomfortable? Who here, hands up, who here is like super into astrology? Alex, close your eyes for a second. Who here is really, really into astrology? Like, make sure every day you're reading the astrological information in the news. No? Not a lot of people? How many people are really into, like, dream work here? Makes us a little uncomfortable. Doesn't it sound a little bit new age, kind of weird? You know, late night television when the people come on and they say, call us up and we'll be a psychic to your pets or whatever. Like, it doesn't sound a little strange? This is a strange story. This is in the Bible. This is in Matthew 2. It's not even Matthew 3. This is Matthew 2. This is like early, early in the gospel. Some astrologers following a star have the revelation that this is where Jesus is. They're the first Gentiles to meet him. And it never actually says that they repented of their astrology. The last thing we hear is they heard in a dream that they should go a different way. And so they do. There's an epiphany. God is speaking to them. To them, not to King Herod. To them, to these guys, that's weird. That's strange. I'm not sure that we would be happy if some strange foreigners came into our service today with their star charts and told us that they knew what God was up to. Would you give them the mic? I mean, probably not. Right? Would we listen? Probably we wouldn't. Not without an epiphany. What do we risk missing when we only allow the truth to come to us in ways in which we are comfortable? From people or situations that fit within our concept of acceptable. Look, I deal with this all the time. I live in the downtown East Side, and there are people with genuine revelation and wisdom from the Lord, and they are simply not listened to. One of my favorite things to do, and I should do it one day if I'm invited here, is to bring some of my friends. I get invited to speak, but I say, actually, I want to give the mic to them and let them speak, because they don't typically get invited to churches to speak, but they have wisdom to share. And sometimes also they're crazy. And sometimes I'm crazy. And sometimes you're crazy. Right? But where do we, what are we, who are we willing to listen to? Where are we willing to receive a revelation from the Lord? What if God chooses to speak through the unlikely? Are we actually prepared to hear him? Are our ears set to the frequency of God, which is not the frequency of empire? This matters. Because the nativity story doesn't work without epiphany. It doesn't work without divine revelation. People make decisions all through that story that they would not make by their own wisdom. They only make that decision because they heard something from God. Zechariah and Elizabeth, their answered prayer in the temple. Mary's pregnancy and Joseph choosing to stay with her. It actually says he was a righteous man and he was going to put her aside honorably. That was the best wisdom he had, and that's what he would have done if an angel didn't come and say, actually, this is what God wants. Okay, that doesn't make sense, but I'm going to do it. The Magi following the star, the shepherds leaving their flocks to see the new baby, people finding Jesus, giving him gifts, the Magi giving him gifts that represented his kingship, his priesthood, his sacrificial death. Then them refusing to go back and talk to Herod. Herod, who was the power in the land, said, you come back and see me. And they said, actually, we're going a different way. Why? Not by their own wisdom, because they were warned in a dream. Joseph being warned in a dream that Herod was going to kill all the children in the area. I don't know if you know this, but families don't just on a whim pick up all their stuff and leave their country. They don't just do it because they think it's a neat idea. People leave where they are because there is a genuine threat to their lives. The Holy Family became refugees to Egypt because of a reasonable threat to their life that they learned in a dream. All types of epiphanies, divine knowledge from behind the veil made the nativity and our salvation possible. Do epiphanies still happen today? What do you think? Yeah? No? Are there still epiphanies today? I believe there are. In fact, I know refugees who were warned in dreams to leave or to hide or to move. And oftentimes, they will run into systems and people who are operating only according to the logic of greed, fear, oppression, empire. I remember a Christian leader in 2016 saying, how can we let refugees into Canada if we can't be sure that they aren't our enemies? I'll say that again. How can we let refugees into Canada if we can't be sure they aren't our enemies? That is a political position that many people hold. And I could give a political answer to that. I could have a good political discussion around that. And that's an okay thing to do. We can have political discussions. But is there not a better answer to that for us, followers of Jesus, more in line with Epiphany? What revelation have we been given about the nature of God, the person of Jesus, the life that we as his followers, his Gentile followers, are called into? So I ask the question, do we have a political answer or an epiphany answer to these questions? What are we told to do about the poor, the orphan, the widow, the foreigner, our enemies? What have we been told to do by revelation? I will say that far too many Christians, in my opinion, are satisfying themselves with partisan political answers to these questions, both right and left. But we have already been given an epiphany, a revelation from the child whom the Magi came from far away to honor and to worship. Mark 8:15. I think we have it on the screen. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. These Pharisees and Herod were two very different political, even spiritual, religious options, and neither of them was the option of Jesus. Jesus' way with self-sacrificing love, even for our enemies, and especially for the poor. And if we are followers of Jesus, recipients of the blessing of Abraham and the fruit of the epiphany to the Gentiles, then that should affect everything. There is no compartmentalization. There is no, we will follow Jesus in church on Sunday and follow the way of empire for the rest of the week politically. That doesn't work. It doesn't work. It should affect everything, especially the way that we engage with those who are suffering most in the world. See, the message of Epiphany is not simply that the good news of the gospel was offered to the Gentiles, us included. It is that. But it is also that we are now included in the covenantal command to be a blessing to the world. That's our job, our role. The role of Herod, the role of the secondary empires, it is to buoy up, to bolster, to legitimize the empire. That's not our role. Our role is to be a covenantal blessing to the world in and through the person of Jesus. So we're going to take communion together